Thank you. Thank you, Jean-Daniel. Thank you for inviting me to this great workshop. So this talk will be about some relation between statistics and topological data analysis, and I will try to present some ideas and some methods in this topic. And I will also show you a small presentation of what can be done with GUDI and statistics with maybe some other libraries. So I will try to do some Python for, during the talk. Okay. Okay. So in a few words, what the idea, in practice for using topological data analysis for analysis point cloud, the idea is that there is interesting information in the geometry and the topology of point clouds, and we would like to extract this information for maybe some task in exploratory and in supervised setting when we want to predict some quantity or maybe to get some information on the structure of the data points. And there is maybe two popular methods in TDNR, which is the mapper algorithm and persistence homology. And I will talk about persistence homology today. And I think this is an important topic, and there is a lot of connection between, well, there's a lot of things that can be done with statistics related to persistence homology. Okay, so why is it interesting to use some topology for analyzing some data point? Because the information which is provided by TDA's multiscore, it is compact and it is invariant under coordinate changes, which is something really important in practice when we have to decide what are the axes for the data. It is also stable with respect to small perturbation, and we expect that it is informative in some particular setting. So the idea is to build some topological descriptor and to use this topological descriptor to do some prediction and to do some analysis. There is probably two main ways to use TDA in practice. I mean, from my practitioner point of view, it can be done for exploratory analysis by defining some signatures, some topological signatures, and then trying to analyze these signatures for themselves, trying to understand what they mean, I mean, in terms of topology. And there is another way to use these signatures is to use them in a standard pipeline of machine learning. For instance, when we define the signatures with other signatures, some topological, some geometric descriptors, some spectral signatures, we put all these things together and we try to design some clever algorithm to predict some output quantity. So for instance, in this example, we try to predict the activity of somebody who is walking with a sensor which is recorded on a cell phone, for instance. Okay, so now, if I'm playing with TDA in a statistical point of view, this means that I consider data as generated from an unknown distribution, exactly as in the previous talk. And it also means that the quantity I get from TDA corresponds to some underlying estimator of some topological object, exactly like as in the previous talk too. And so we would like to get a rigorous framework to present this idea and to get some convergence results for the convergence of the topological feature to some underlying object, for instance. This is one of the questions we would like to answer. During the last years, there's been quite a lot of work, actually, in the connection on this topic, in the connection between TDA and statistics and statistical learning. I try to give a list on maybe the main topic, but of course all the questions are not presented here, and there are also a lot of other work. But one of the main questions is related to the consistency and the convergence of these TDA methods. Another important question is to propose some confident region for TDA methods, something really important in practice. Another interesting question is to define some notion of central tendency for persistence homology. What is the mean behavior for persistence homology? what is the mean of a persistent diagram, for instance, of a family of persistent diagram. It's also important to propose some robust method for TDA, because in practice TDA is not also very robust to outliers or to this kind of problem. There's also a lot of work on about the representation of persistence, because to plug some standard and classical supervised methods in machine learning, it's really more easy to do it in Euclidean space. So there's a lot of work to transform the topological feature and to put them in a Euclidean space to just then to do some standard machine learning algorithm. There's also a lot of work to develop kernels for topological descriptor now, and also some work on the analysis of mapper from a statistical point of view. Okay. So now, very quickly, because it's a topic for itself, and this is not the main part of my talk, but I will just remind you the idea of homology inference and persistence homology inference, and then I will put some statistics on these things. So if I try to recover some topological information on a shape, and if I want to give some results for this kind of problem, I need some notion of regularity, as for probably most problem in mathematics. So there's quite a lot of notions of regularity in geometry inference. Maybe one of the most popular is the notion of reach, which is really related to what you talked just before in your talk, this notion of bottleneck problem between two clusters. And this notion of reach has been defined by Federer, and it's a nice way to control the way in the same time the curvature of the shape and the way the shape is organized and does not self-intersect at some point. So this notion of reach here is here to control this kind of problem. Probably exactly, there is some strong connection, I think, with the definition you used in the previous talk. Okay, so just to give you an idea of the kind of results we are interested in here, this is a result from Frédéric Chazal and André Letier. Here, the idea is just to show you that there is some strong connection with a topic in statistics, which is estimation of support, which is not really surprising. In these results here, we see that under some regularity assumption, which is related to what I presented just before in the previous slide, what's happening is that let's say that it is possible to infer some topological information if the two shapes are not too bad. Let's say they are regular enough, and if they are close enough. The distance here is the Hausdorff distance between the two shapes, which means that from a statistical point of view, the connection here is that if I'm able to estimate the support of a shape for the Hausdorff metric, I will be able to give some statistical results for the homotopy inference directly from what is known about support estimation for the Hausdorff metric. So here there is a quite natural connection between a topic in statistics, which is support estimation under Hausdorff metric, and homotopy homotopy inference, for instance. The thing is that homotopy is not easy, of course, to compute in practice, and something which is more easy to deal with in practice is singular homology. So singular homology here, I would just say that it provides an algebraic description of holes in a geometric shape, and we are specifically interested here in the Betti number, which gives the rank of the homology group. And just again to show the idea of how to connect some statistics with topological inference, here these results from Nyogi, Smell and Van Berger show that it is possible to infer the Betti number on a Riemannian manifold with positive reach with high probability. So this was probably the first result that connect some probabilistic results with geometry and topology inference. And in some sense, it was quite important for the film, because it was probably the first attempt to do these two things at the same time, to put some probability and some statistics for homology and for homology inference in this case. The thing is that homology inference in practice, doing some homology inference is not so easy, and there is some problem of stability. And it is easier to do to infer some notion of persistence homology, which actually consists in tracking the evolution of topology along a filtration of simplicial complexes or along a filtration. And this gives you a multiscal information and some more stable and more robust information. So this is what I'm more specifically interested in this talk. So the idea is to track the evolution of some topological feature along the filtration. Here, in this case, assume that we have some point cloud, and we look at how the topological feature evolves along this filtration, and in what is called a persistent diagram, represents the date of birth and the date of death of this topological feature. So in this context here, there is of course a wall inside the circle that appears at some point and disappears at some point along the filtration. So this is typically the kind of thing we are interested in and we would like to infer. So if you remember what I said before, I would like to see this kind of object as an estimator of an underlying object that is of course related to the distribution of the data point. So if we do, well, of course, if you want to do some statistics and some analysis with persistent diagram, we need some metric on the top of this persistent diagram. There is a notion of distance between persistent diagram, which is nice because it provides some stability. So this distance here is the bottleneck distance, which is a matching distance. The idea is to measure the cost of moving from one diagram to the other, and to take this cost as this minimal cost as the definition of the metric. And something which is really interesting is that this metric provides you some stability of the construction. So they say that if you have two shapes which are close for the Hausdorff distance, then the two persistent diagrams that are derived from this construction will be close together. So this means that if you want to analyze the convergence of a persistent diagram to the persistent diagram to an underlying object, it is possible to analyze these things simply directly in the sampling space by using this kind of stability. So, okay, now we'll try to do some statistics with persistence homology. So this is the picture, the idea of the framework. We start from a metric space, and we sample some point on a compact set X. So this gives you a data point here. From this data point, you define a filtration, a simplicial filtration. This filtration is, of course, a random object. It can be seen as an estimator. From this filtration, we define a persistent diagram. And this persistent diagram here, we would like to see it as an estimator of an underlying object. So what's happening is here that it is also possible to define a filtration for the continuous object and a persistent diagram for this continuous object too. So then using the stability results I show you just here, it is just quite easy to prove some convergence and to derive also some convergence rates for the convergence of a persistent diagram here to some underlying object, which is the persistent diagram of the support of the distribution actually. So the target in this context is simply the persistent diagram defined on the filtration of the support of the distribution. So from this general picture, it's then possible to derive some rates of convergence. So it is also some minimax rates of convergence in this case, as in the talk of Sanjoy. So here, if you want to if we want to understand what is difficult in this problem, the problem will be difficult if there is some area in the distribution where there is no mass. So we need to control the minimal amount of mass on the support of the distribution. So this is actually a quite standard problem in support estimation, and there have been quite a lot of propositions, and probably the most popular way to control the minimal quantity of mass on the distribution is this notion of AB standard assumption that was proposed, for instance, by Tsibakov in the past. It's only say that the mass of the distribution of the ball grows as a power of R, where R is the radius of the ball, and you assume that this minimal quantity of mass grows at least at some power of R. And B here, the power on R, actually corresponds to some kind of intrinsic dimension, and it's also related to the VC dimension too. So it's some kind of description of the intrinsic dimension of the support of the distribution. And then, from the previous stability results I show you, it's quite easy to derive some minimax rates of convergence over this kind of family of distribution, which give you exactly the same rates of convergence as what you find if you look at estimation of the support of the distribution under Hausdorff metric, which is not surprising. What's interesting here is that if you want to look at lower bound, it's not Fano in this context, but using a standard Lecamus argument, you can find a minimal, you can show that the lower bound also almost match up to the log, and the Fano argument does not give you the log in this context. So, well, but you can show that the log, you can get the log in some particular context in this way. Well, by the way, the rates of convergence you obtain here are minimax up to the log. So something which is more interesting for the practice is to design some confidence region, because if you have a persistence diagram and in practice you would like to know what is significant and what is not significant. So remind that in this persistence diagram, each point corresponds to a particular topological feature. So think about a wall, for instance, inside the point cloud, or two connected components that appears or disappears at some point in the filtration. So the x-axis is the date of birth and the y-axis is the date of death. So of course, everything which is on the diagonal corresponds to something that appears and disappears almost in the same time. So usually what people say is that this kind of objects are not significant, or at least are, not easy to distinguish from the noise. Maybe it is significant, but the thing is that maybe you don't have enough points to say that this point is significant. So the idea here is to design some confidence region for the persistence diagram. In other terms, to say, okay, these points here, I believe in them because I have enough confidence on what I have estimated here. So, and this is really important because we would like to be sure of what is estimated in this context. So this is work from a Faysian co-author from CMU, when they did this work, where they use a lot of subsampling and bootstrap strategy to design some confidence region for persistence diagram. And at the end, what you obtain is this kind of band that says that what is in the band is not easy to distinguish from noise. So and what is up to the band corresponds to some significant signal. And this is really important for practitioners to have this kind of information. In this context, we cannot really directly use some bootstrap. They use some subsampling strategy. But well, maybe I will go fast on this idea because this is not what I want to develop here. But really, the idea is to look at the variability of the objects. The idea is to subsample inside the initial point cloud and to look at what's happening in the variation. And you catch this variation by doing this subsampling project. And you at the end, you estimate this band, you tune this band by looking at the variation by doing this subsampling strategy. by looking at the variation by subsampling inside the initial point cloud. This is the idea behind subsampling and bootstrap strategies. Okay. So convergence rates, confidence region, and another important question in what is the notion of central tendency for persistence homology. In many applications, you don't have one persistence diagram, you have a complete family of persistence diagrams. And you would like to have some clusters sometimes, maybe some representation of maybe one persistence diagram that corresponds to the mean behavior of this family of persistence diagrams. So actually, there's maybe two different directions of research on this topic at the moment. The first way to do this is to look at a notion of Frechet mean, which corresponds to a rigorous notion of means in metric spaces like this one, because it has the correct mathematical properties to define this notion of Frechet mean. But the thing that in practice, computing these Frechet means is really not obvious. And so it gives you a nice notion of mean from a mathematical point of view, but there is some really difficult problem for computing this Frechet mean. And usually it is not unique, so which is not something very nice for the practice. Another direction of research is to put all this topological descriptor in a linear space, in an Euclidean space, and then to compute some mean in this Euclidean space where there is no any more problem to compute some mean. So this is the alternative that has been proposed by Bubnik, for instance, which is another way to represent this topological descriptor. So starting from a persistence diagram on the left, you define a family of piecewise constant of tenting curve on the right, and then in this space, it is a functional space. It is possible to define some notion of mean, because here doing the mean between this kind of this kind of objects is not a problem anymore. So here the idea is just to start from the persistence diagram, to define a new axis which corresponds to the diagonal, to look at this tenting function, and to define the k max tenting function from this family of tenting function defined from the diagonal. So what is important is that this family of curves are stable with respect to the bottleneck metric in the space of persistence diagram, and so it is also of course stable with respect to the observed distances in the initial space, for instance. Now, something which is possible in this context and which can be really useful in practice if you have a very big data point, it's really difficult to compute persistence homology when the size of the point cloud is too large. Then what can be done is to subsample inside this family of point cloud and to define this mean here, which corresponds to an average over this family of landscape. So this is a landscape here, the blue one, for instance. Then I subsample in the point cloud. I subsample by taking, for instance, m points in the initial point cloud, and I define a notion of mean with this object. And what's nice is that this object here, which corresponds to the expectation, this expectation under the landscape here, are stable with respect to some Wasserstein metrics, for instance. So I'm going very fast, but the idea is just to make you understand that by putting all these objects in a Euclidean space, it is then possible to define some notion of mean. And this means can be really useful for the practice because they are stable, and something which is really important, they are also discriminative in practice. It's not possible to prove a corresponding lower bound, but in practice, for instance, here we did some experiment to prove that this kind of signatures is important to distinguish between several behavior. It is possible to use this kind of signature to do some classification, for instance, between a family of landscapes. Okay. So I will not. I don't want to develop this kind of idea more. But I would like to show you what can be done with a Goody library on a specific example. I think it will be more interesting. So this is just the commercial break about Goody and how we can plug Goody with other libraries, and how, just to show you that it can be done very, very easily now. So I'm on the right part of the diagram on the Cython and Python interface of Goody. And okay. So this is just a Jupyter notebook, which is one of the way to play with Python and to load some libraries and to do some data science with many libraries that are now available. So I started from an example from Bubnyk, which is protein binding. So the idea is just to analyze the structure of the protein. But the protein is not described by its geometric representation in R3. The protein is represented by a correlation matrix that describes the dynamics between residues defined on the protein. Okay, so each protein is represented by the correlation matrix that is supposed to represent the general structure of the protein itself. So one protein gives you one correlation matrix that represents the dynamic of the protein. From this correlation matrix, I can define a dissimilarity. Let's say a metric. I'm not sure it is a metric, but I will say that it is a metric in this case. So now, if I have a metric, I can define a Ripps filtration from this metric. And then I can compute Ripps filtration from this metric. I can compute persistence homology and play with this persistence homology. Okay, so I just import the library I need, so NumPy, Goody, Pandas, Seaborn, Matplotlib, scikit-learn or standard libraries for Python. Okay, I load the data I need to do this. Okay, this is just the correlation matrix. Each of these files corresponds to a correlation matrix. I have a 14 correlation matrix. From this correlation matrix, I define a distance matrix for each one. So this gives me a family of distances. So each family of matrix of distances corresponds to some kind of metric space. And I just check that, okay, I have these distances in here. This is an example of a matrix of distances, one of the 14 distances. Okay, so I compute the Ripps filtration for the first matrix of distances. Okay, it's done. Now I compute the persistence along the simplex tree, and I can plot it to visualize the topological feature. Here it is. Okay, so the red one corresponds to the homology of degree zero, and the green one to the homology of degree one. Okay, and I can also from this formation, I would like to have an idea of what's insignificant in this context. What is the significant in this topological feature? So I just here, all these things will be quite soon completely automatic, but now for the moment I have to do my bootstrap at hand. So this is just a few lines to do the bootstrap, okay? And I can add, at the end I found the length of the band that I had to represent on the diagram, and it gives me the kind of information. So okay, so these bands here corresponds to what is lost in the noise, and what is up on the band corresponds to significant information. Okay, so this is an example of what can be done now. I have 14 distances, 14 for sorry sorry 14 matrix of distances, so 14 persistent diagram. So I compute all the persistent diagram. And now I compute the matrix of bottleneck distance between the 14 objects. So this gives me a matrix of 14 by 14. Okay, so it takes a little of time. So I have already computed it for you. And finally, okay. So I would like to. So this gives me a matrix of distances, and I would like to visualize the configuration of these 14 protein in a simple way. Okay. at that point I could do some classification or whatever, but just to show you, I just load some scikit-learn library, for instance, to do some multidimensional scaling to visualize the things, and finally I obtain this kind of thing, which each point here corresponds to one protein. So, okay, I can also play with landscape in this context, etc. Just to illustrate the fact that it's quite easy now to interface GUDI with other existing libraries in statistics and machine learning. Okay, so this is the end of the commercial break. And I go back to my talk. So, to finish the talk, I will say a few words about what is robust TDA, because one of the problems with topological data analysis is that it can be really sensitive to outliers. For instance, if I study the sublevel set of the distance function to a cycle, if there is no noise, everything is nice. I have this nice distance function, the persistence diagram to the sublevel set of this distance function is nice, and I recover exactly what I want. But of course, as I have a little of noise inside the cycle, things start to be very bad, and I have a lot of noise that appears also in the persistence diagram, which is not surprising, because I have these points here that can be really, it can be really painful in practice, this noise. Well, to analyze this kind of situation, there's different noise models that has been proposed in the literature. For instance, you can suppose there is some additive noise model, and if you know the structure of the noise, then it is possible to do some deconvolution, but usually you don't, it's really difficult. So there is still a lot of work on this topic in statistics, but estimating the noise distribution is really not easy, and then doing the deconvolution with an estimated noise is, well, it's possible, but it's quite difficult in practice. You can assume that there is some clutter noise, that's some kind of some uniform noise added to the structure, and you can also have some few outliers. So in practice, it's really difficult to have some one general statistical model for the noise, and usually you don't know what is the distribution, what's the distribution of the noise you have on the data. And one idea that has been proposed by some guys that are here today, so Frédéric Chazal, David Cohensteiner, and Quentin Mirigo, it's to, instead of looking at the distance to the object, is to look at the distance to the measure, to take into account the portion of mass. And this notion of distance to measure makes TDA methods much more robust, actually. So the idea is the following. Starting from a point X, you look at the support of the distribution, the support of P here, and instead of looking at the minimal distance to the support of P, you would like to, you require a minimal amount of mass for looking at this distance. You don't want to take the closest point, you want to catch a minimal portion of mass. So, you consider actually what is in statistics a quantile function of the distance from a point to the random variable, and what you're doing is that you integrate the minimal distance you need to catch a portion of mass. So this is the delta PU is a quantile function at U of the random variable, which is the distance from the point, the observation point X, to the random variable big X. But instead of taking directly this quantile function from some regularity or problem, you need to integrate this quantity here. And finally, you get this distance function, which is the distance to the measure. And this distance to measure will be used in TDA procedure instead of the standard distance function. Okay, so this distance to the measure has some nice property. It is stable with respect to Wasserstein distance, for instance. It is also semi-concave, and this ensures some strong regularity properties of the geometry of the sublevel set, which is nice for geometry inference. And if a probability distribution is closed for the Wasserstein distance, then this means that the sublevel set of the distance to this other distance will provide a topological correct approximation of the support of P. Which means that by, for instance, if you have a point cloud which is not so far from the Wasserstein distance of the underlying distribution, then using this distance, you will recover a topological correct approximation of the support of P, which is something which is nice. But as you can see here, the stability result is not anymore for some Hausdorff or some subnorm quantity. It is with respect to a metric between the distribution, the Wasserstein distance, the Wasserstein 2 distance between the two distributions. In practice, of course, we don't play with the true underlying distribution. We only have point cloud and we have the empirical distribution. And we can compute the distance to the empirical distribution in a quite direct way, because it is nothing more than looking at the nearest neighbor to the observation point. So from an observation point X, you look at the closest neighbor in the point cloud to X, and you average the distance between the observation point and the closest neighbor in the point cloud. And of course, you have to choose the number of neighbors you take in this quantity here. So in the distance to measure, there is always this parameter that corresponds to the portion of mass you require to define the distance to measure. Okay. So something which is nice. Okay, I think I will skip this and I will go to the last part. So, just to show you what's happening with this new distance to measure, with this alternative distance, because now it's not really new. So, starting from this example on the left, you can compute the distance to measure, and you can compute the distance function, and you can compare with what's happening with the distance to measure. So, in the first case, everything goes wide because there is no problem, there is no noise, but as soon as you add noise, what's happening is that the distance function will be perturbated by the noise and will have some problem to recover the correct topological feature. But on the last lines, if you use a distance to measure in this context, the less distance to measure is much less sensitive to the outlier, and the distance to measure will be able to recover the correct topological feature that corresponds to the Cassini curve. So on the last picture on the right, you can see that the topological feature are upon the confidence region, and so we're happy with this because, of course, it corresponds to the underlying structure we would like to infer. So what's happening is that if you start from a point cloud, you can, of course. So this is a general picture for doing some TDA with the distance to measure. Starting from a point cloud, we can define a distance to measure to this point to the empirical measure. This gives you a persistent diagram, and according to the two stability results, the stability results from bottleneck to the subnorm, which coming, for instance, from Cohen-Steiner and Coauteur, and then the stability result of the DTM, the stability for the subnorm of the distance to measure for the Wasserstein distance. This means that this construction is stable with respect to the Wasserstein distance. This construction, I mean, the persistent diagram defined on the distance to measure are stable with respect to the Wasserstein distance between the two distributions. So now we would like to understand what's happening with this distance to measure, and we would like to control the convergence. And using, for instance, this inequality, it is possible to derive also some rates of convergence and to understand what's happening for the convergence of this object. Something which is really important is that the distance to measure can be rewriting as an integration over a quantile function. So I will not go further into the details, but starting from this observation, it is possible to analyze the convergence of the distance to measure. I mean, the convergence of the distance to the empirical measure to the distance to the underlying object. And starting from this observation, it is possible to analyze the asymptotic of this object and the non-asymptotic, and to give also some non-asymptotic results for this quantity of interest, which is the square distance of the distance to the empirical measure minus the square distance to the underlying distribution. And something which is quite important here is that actually we do not use Wasserstein stability, because Wasserstein, it is quite known in probability now. Well, there's quite a lot of work recently about the rates of convergence in Wasserstein for Wasserstein metric, but these rates of convergence are not sufficient to obtain the correct rates of convergence for the convergence of the distance to the empirical measure. So actually, we do it directly by analyzing the quantile process. And maybe to finish, I will just show you how to play with bootstrap in this context. And there is actually two different ways to do some bootstrap for the distance to measure. So let's start with directly bootstrapping the distance to measure. So what's the idea behind bootstrap? So assume that you subsample under a distribution P, and so you obtain an empirical distribution Pn, and you can play exactly the same game by subsampling inside the empirical measure. So this gives you the bootstrap measure, which is nothing more than subsampling endpoints inside the empirical measure. And what's happening is that in the good cases, the variation between P and Pn can be compared to the variation between Pn and P star n. And this is some kind of magical results of bootstrap that allow you to estimate the variability between P and Pn by only subsampling inside Pn. And this is something we use a lot in statistics when it is possible, or sometimes we use some sample, as I presented before, when it is not possible to do bootstrap, but this is really the main idea of this technique. What's happening is that instead of playing with P, you are computing some functional on the top of P. If this functional is not too bad, you need, for instance, some notion of Hadamard differentiability, then it will also possible to estimate the variability in between phi of p, phi of pn, from the variability between phi of pn and phi of pn star. And this is something we use a lot in this context. When we don't really know what's happening in the metric spaces, by simply subsampling, we try to estimate in this way the variability of the process. Actually, this is the idea now. Starting from a point cloud, we subsample inside Pn, so that x star 1, x star n. From this gives you a p star n within a subsample, a point cloud which has been bootstrapped inside Pn. Then from this, we estimate the quantile of the subnorm between the distance measure to the empirical measure minus the distance to measure to the bootstrap measure, and by this way we estimate the quantile the quantile we need to define confidence region. So this is a big technical, but the idea is really we do some bootstrap on the point cloud to estimate by this way the band we need for the final to get some confidence region for the distance to measure, for the persistent diagram of the distance to measure. There is also another way to do that. It's to directly look at what's happening in the metric space by directly looking at how the persistence diagram evolves by doing some bootstrap in the initial point cloud. So this is what we call bottleneck bootstrap, by directly doing the bootstrap, by measuring the variability in the metric space. And usually doing this, we observe some better confidence region. So this is the bottleneck bootstrap. We have the persistent diagram of the sublevel set of the distance to measure. We have the persistent diagram of the sublevel set of the distance to the empirical measure, and the persistent diagram of the sublevel set of the distance to the bootstrap measure. And we directly bootstrap in the set of persistent diagram by considering the random quantity, which is the bottleneck distance between the bootstrap diagram and the estimated diagram. And this gives us a quantile that can be used to design some confidence region. Okay, so this is just a summary of what's happening. By directly doing the bootstrap in the first way, usually we get some larger confidence, some larger band than by doing it directly on the space of the persistent diagram. And the reason is that usually the stability result is not tiny enough to get a very good estimation of the confidence region. Okay. Okay, so I think I will finish with this. So TDA methods focus on the topological properties of a shape, and TDA methods, as I explained in the beginning, can be used, I mean, from a practitioner point of view, as an exploratory method, in particular where the point cloud is sampled on and close a real geometric object, but it can be used also as a feature extraction procedure, and then we can plug some standard algorithm to do some learning tasks. TDAs emerge is an emerging field at the interface between mathematics, computer science, and statistics, and that's why I think it's really exciting. There's quite many topics now about statistic analysis of TDA, and also a lot of application during the last year in medicine, biology, and etc. I think we'll have some presentation of this topic in the rest of the day. Thank you. Thank you.